Committee substitute for House Bill number 105, loans, an act relating to the authority of the bonds or notes, establish conditions under which the bonds or notes for the Geelong Mountain Transportation Projects may be issued and provided for an effective date. This bill is the original sponsor is the governor. The particular bill does two things. Section 1 increases the international airport bond authorization from $63 million to $86.5 million. This additional authority is needed to pay for phase 2 of the Anchorage Airport improvements. The rest of the bill authorized ADA to set up approximately $175 million in bonds for the road and port needed to develop the Red Dog Mine and set various terms and conditions that must be met before the bonds can be sold. I have prepared a financier for your review that further refines these terms and conditions. The fiscal note for the bill only deals with the additional airport bond authorization. As you know, the appropriations necessary to capitalize the Red Dog Mine bonds are provided in another appropriation bill. I'd like at this time to call the chairman of the House Special Committee on Loans, Representative Sund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Loans Committee, what I'd like to do here is just go through what the Loans Committee proposed in the bill and some of the reasons for it. The Loans Committee did adopt amendment to House Bill 105, putting in sections 2 and 3, 4 and 5 of the bill. Section 2 is an authorization to ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development Authority, to issue bonds not to exceed $175 million. The statutes require any bonding authority for them over $50 million has to have specific legislative approval, and that's what this does. The third section is lays out some conditions, the first of which is that the ADA comply with AS 4488173, which is on the top of page 2. That is the requirement to come forth with a financing plan, which should provide the descriptions of the sources of the money, the total cost of the project, operationals of the project. In addition to that, the Loans Committee added several other conditions, which over the testimony that we had had in the committee, we had about 5 hearings on this project, are added in. An agreement that they get in writing from Cominco. It's in top of page 2 that the Cominco will pay for the operation of the facilities, the O&M costs. Secondly, that Cominco, if they ever cease to develop the Red Dog before it's completed and the state's expended any money or ADA's expended any money, that they shall repay those monies. And thirdly, that a toll fee schedule be set out that includes some periodic adjustments in the toll prices. All of this to be done prior to the issuance of any bonds. The other subsections on page 2 stipulated that the land exchange right-of-way through the monument must be completed before the bond sales could take place. That also that Nana Corporation agree to make the right-of-way available at no more than fair market value for the port and road construction. That the maximum amount of tax-exempt financing be used, and a toll schedule that can be adjusted periodically be provided for that ensures that there's access for a rate of return on the state's investment. It also guarantees access to the facilities by all users. There are some other potential mines up in that area, and that they have to have access to this road and port. The section 6 there is added in by the House C, or the Finance CS, was not in the original bill out of loans, which provides that contracts for the construction, operation, and maintenance of the port and road are subject to AS 36, which I would believe is the Little Davis-Bacon law. Although I'm not
That's similar to the language of the Senate bill.
And subsection 7 is added in that reasonable access to the port and road is guaranteed to all users. The fourth section is one that came to my attention when doing some research in this in terms of looking at the economic development account in ADA into which this money is going to be paid, and that's where the toll revenues would go when they come back. And I believe after reading the AG's opinion regarding the HFC issues, it really, which was issued on April 24th, to you, Mr. Chairman, it really struck hard in my mind that something like this is required, because it has nothing really to do with ADA or CAMINC or any of this project. It just says that this economic development account is going to be the recipient of the toll fees if this project is as huge a success on the top end as we hope it might be. That account could accumulate tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, with no way for those dollars to come back into the general fund. And although we searched long and hard for some way to amend the statute, it's 4488-172 is the statute, it's the Economic Development Fund. We couldn't do it in this bill. And this language here requires that there be an agreement between the Department of Revenue and ADA that any money above and beyond that necessary for the principal and interest on the bonds and notes be deposited in the general fund. And I'm not quite sure it's going to be totally adequate to my regard, and I'm going to continue on that issue, but in the legal opinion that was delivered to you, Mr. Chairman, by Mr. Baldwin regarding the HFC, he does talk about third-party dedication or third parties coming in and depending upon these revenues to be available to pay the bonds. And I think by putting this language in here, and you might question aid of people when they testify, whether that could be made a condition of the bond sale so that the bondholders, when they purchase the bonds, are made aware of the fact that any excess monies in this fund above and beyond that necessary to pay the bonds are going back to the general fund. And I think if the bond purchasers know that going in, they don't have any third-party claim to say that we're taking assets away that may be pledged to the bonds. And I don't know if bond counsel's here, or Bird or Terry, you guys can talk about that, but that's a big concern that I have in terms of somehow to get this money back out of this fund. The other item, Mr. Chairman, I would note that's not in here, it is provided in this legislation, but it would be my argument or point of view that the toll fees being paid here should be paid on a basis that is somewhat related to the state's investment, but just repayment of the state's investment should not mean the toll fees should stop being paid. I think if this is a state equity investment in here, if we're going to go in on an equity basis, I think we can take the point of view that it's a toll road, and it's a toll road as long as the road operates. And hopefully that will return a reasonable return on the state's investment, and hopefully it could make an excellent return on the state's investment. But it's just something that's not in this piece of legislation right now. It tells ADA to negotiate a toll fee with CAMINCO, but I think we just keep in mind that if they negotiated one that says we're just going to keep charging a toll fee, I would feel a lot better about it. And with that, I'll take any questions. That is what happened in the Loans Committee. And I don't see anything. The proposed CS here, I think, is totally with the intent of what the Loans Committee was doing. And although there's three members of the Loans Committee here on your committee, I have no objection to any of the amendments that were made. I think they actually helped the bill.
Representative Juling, questions?
Just one brief question. I believe in the Loans Committee substitute on page 3 at the end, is it correct that we've actually deleted the language money that goes into the general fund versus money that would go back into the ADA loan fund?
Well, I represent you, and Mr. Chairman, I think on line 16 there on page 3 of the proposed
CS.
Finance CS, they've just rewritten that. I think it makes a little more sense the way it's rewritten.
I agree with that. I just want to make sure I understand, I understand
right.
It, of course.
What I'd like to do is to try to bring out the difference between the loans and the loans version and the CS I have before you. And it does take care of your problem there, Representative Mueller. Further questions? Representative Rieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sun, under this, under the CS, is the Alaska Industrial Development Authority able to pledge the state's moral obligation to the debt issued for this project?
Specifically, no. I'm not representing myself as bond counsel, but the language in 4488-172, the Economic Development Fund, specifically says that if a project is financed or developed through the use of assets of the Economic Development Fund, the authority may not pledge or use other assets of the authority. So not only I don't want to say the moral obligation of the state is never, but the legal obligation of the state is not there, and also none of the other assets of ADA can be pledged against this project if they use this development fund to fund the project. So in general question, is the moral obligation of the state there? I'll defer that to bond counsel. My guess is that the moral obligation of the state is probably behind most of our continuing entities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question on page two, the question, and I guess I should preface my remarks by saying I'm not opposed to the project. I like the project, but I'm trying to address the things that came up in some of the other projects the state's undertaken. When you list on line three, Cominco Limited is required to agree in writing that, and then you list A, B, and C. Do you see any difference between that and saying to agree by valid enforceable contract or some other language like that, which makes it clear that not only what the agreement is, but that it's an enforceable agreement?
Well, I like the thrust of what you're saying. We use Cominco Limited as the entity here because I don't think Cominco Alaska, which is, I don't want, to me, a guarantee from Cominco Alaska, if their only assets the mine, really isn't very valid. So we tried to get to Cominco Limited. But the intent is that, yeah, it'd be valid, binding, and it'd be enforceable, that there'd be assets behind it. And I would leave that up to ADA and to maybe explain how they're going to do that. But that's the intent of this language here.
Okay. And one last question, and then I'll wait for ADA to testify. On what is being paid, and I'll go to line five on the same page, where they'll pay for all or a portion of the operation and maintenance of facilities constructed as part of the project. Does that clearly include the debt service on the bonds issued as part of operation and maintenance?
No, that's operation and maintenance.
Okay.
And the all or a portion phrase is that if they're the only user, it would be intended they pay all of it, but if there's another user, then the O&M would be split between the users.
Okay, can you point to where the provision for the payment of debt services in here?
The only payment provided from Cominco would be from toll fees used on the road, which would be lines 13 through 17.
Okay, that's not linked to the debt service on the bonds.
And then also on the, no, it's not. And then on page bottom, on item 5 on the next page, the toll schedule sets out two requirements, a reasonable return on the state's investment and equitable access provision.
Okay, so you would read A on page 3 to mean that you'd pay the debt service plus something which constitutes return as part of that?
Well, as I stated earlier, I think you got to figure out what a reasonable return is. I'm not into that argument too much, but my point was that not only should you think about getting a return on your investment, I don't know if you want to treat it as a loan or an investment basis, but it should get the money back, but I think it ought to keep going on and on. I think, if it turns out as huge as these toll fees don't stop, when you get your money plus 2% or your money plus 4% or your money plus 6% implies that when that happens, the tolls would stop being accumulated. It would be my feeling that the tolls ought to just keep on accumulating. If it's a hugely successful project and the state helped get it going, the state ought to reap some benefit out of it.
See, Mr. Chairman,
that's a personal opinion. That is not a Loans Committee opinion. The Loans Committee opinion is in the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just to conclude on that, then you read line A on the top of page 3, reasonable return on the state's investment, meaning, if I hear you right, are we a payment which includes debt service plus some return, and in your mind, reasonable means some return that's commensurate with the risk, and if it's an equity-type risk investment, then it's an equity-type return, along those lines. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I don't know if what you want an answer from me is determinative of where you're going. It doesn't matter. Reasonable return to me would like to get the money back, you know, plus some, you know, I'd love to have 20% return. I think the state made a great investment, but anything above and beyond the money back, I think, is a reasonable return.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But again, it's an equity investment in my mind and not a debt investment.
Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sun, let me throw you a curve here. It's section one of the bill, we're doing, increasing the bonding authority for the Anchorage Airport by $24 million. Is that essentially what we're doing?
Yeah, and that's to provide some bonding capacity for the second phase of the airport.
Second phase. I mean, why wasn't this planned up front and we sold one package?
There's a transmittal letter, I believe, from the governor in there that states out the.
Yeah, I just don't remember what the original.
23 point. Yeah, for the Anchorage International Airport Terminal renovation phase two.
This wasn't part of the original. It's not an old cost overrun that we're dealing with.
Not to my knowledge. But this is a revenue bond basis, too. It's not a GO bond, so.
I do have the later Ron link to answer some of those questions.
Yeah, on the airport basis.
Okay. Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sun, I want to go back here and look at this toll fees and the toll schedule. This is something that I'm trying to tie these two parts of the bill together, and I don't think we discussed this in loans. Page 2. Subsection 1C says toll fees paid by Cominco Alaska for the use of facilities constructed, et cetera, may be periodically adjusted if the price of zinc rises above a level that yields a return on investment commensurate with risk. That says to me that they have to agree under number one here that the toll schedule could be adjusted upwards if the price of zinc goes up. Is that what that means?
Yeah, that's what it means to me, but I would probably advise that the better person to ask would be Ada, who you might ask them what they think these words mean, and because they're the ones going to be entering.
I think that's what it means to me. I think that's what that implies there very strongly. I then looked down at number 5, which is on the bottom of the page, which says, which is another provision that Cominco has to agree to, a toll schedule that may be periodically adjusted is established for use of facilities constructed as part of a project. I'm wondering if those two don't go against each other, because I think 1C is saying they can only be adjusted upward, and 5 leaves it open so you could adjust it down to zero tolls.
I believe 5 says a reasonable return, and then I think a questioning of 8 of what they determine reasonable return might shed some light there. My reading of C would be that yeah, you have a base for which you can go up, but I guess if the market turned down, you could argue that it goes down, too.
Well, I guess I will ask Bert or some whoever.
Yeah, we can be up next.
Yeah, okay.
Representative Cotton.
Oh, I just wondered if the chairman had any objection to removing Section 1 from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have a Judiciary Committee that I need to go to, so... If you have any other questions of me, I'd appreciate it. Otherwise,
no, that's it.
What you do to
we'll
the bill.
That's it. Okay. Thank you, Representative Sun.
Is that question to me?
No. At this time, the chair will call up Bert Wagner and also Terry Elder.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bert Wagner. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Industrial Development Authority. With me is Dr. Terry Elder, who's Deputy Commissioner for Commerce and Economic Development.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Sun gave you a good overview of the bill itself. I'll just point out that we have gone over the bill with bond counsel for ADA on this project, and bond counsel has no problems with this bill.
Representative Rieger, you had some questions regarding ADA.
The same question on the moral obligation pledge. Just wanted to verify that that was, in fact, the case, that it is not to be pledged in this project.
Mr. Chairman, may I answer the question? Representative Rieger, yes, we are able to pledge the moral ob, and we have to have the moral ob. Mr. Chairman, if we don't have the ability to pledge moral ob, we do not think we have the ability to finance this project. All of the authorities' bonds we currently have outstanding have the moral ob. If I may take just a moment to explain exactly what moral obligation is insofar as the authority is concerned. There's a section of my statutes, basically 4488105, Mr. Chairman, and these statutes basically state that we can create capital reserve funds. Generally, capital reserve funds are created to approximate 1 year's average annual debt service. This is basically a savings account or reserve fund to provide security to bondholders. Should we miss a payment on a bond, the trustee may automatically deduct that payment from the capital reserve fund. At that point, I would come to the governor and the legislature, the chairman of the authority, and certify that there was a shortage in that capital reserve fund, and the legislature may, but is not obligated, to appropriate money to replenish that capital reserve fund. The actual specific language that would allow capital reserve fund for this particular type project, a own and operate project, sir, is contained in 4488105H.
Another question on a different issue. This bill provides for, or I'm not sure if this one is the one or someone would appropriate a portfolio of loans to the Alaska Industrial Development Authority that may be used as collateral for the bonds. And I guess my question is, that loan portfolio throws off a cash flow. And what your plans are for expenditures that cash flow in advance of the final adoption of a finance plan and a recommendation to go forward. I mean, I specifically am concerned, you know, what kind of money you'll spend on design or any other event before you make the final go, no-go decision because you've reached an agreement and so on.
Chairman, Representative Rieger, the cash flow from the loans, I doubt seriously would be utilized for anything prior to a go-no-go decision. We do have currently within ADA about $3 million left of the $3.4 million appropriation generally for the DeLong Mountain Transportation Project, and that should certainly be sufficient to cover any costs that might occur between now and a go decision.
That's all I have for now.
I had a question for Mr. Elder. In the Loans Committee meeting, I asked you what the remainder of the financing plan was for the project, and you explained that you had $12 million in ADA funds that were designated, at least now, for multifamily housing. There were $3 million that the previous legislature had appropriated for, I guess, 2 ADA for some studies. Was it an appropriation to ADA?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was an appropriation to ADA, not just for studies, but generally for development of the transportation system.
I understood it was specifically for a contract with Cominco to do a feasibility study. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, no, that is not correct.
Maybe you could tell us what the specific was on that, so I make sure I don't misstate it again.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the wording with me right now, but it was not for a contract or anything necessarily. It was for anything relating to design and development, as I recall, but I can get the exact wording.
I guess I could get that too. I apologize for misstating. I had heard so much about the controversy that surrounded it that the state was going to pay a company to study a project that they wanted to do, so that was why I assumed that was the reason that the appropriation was made. You're saying it wasn't?
Mr. Chairman, no, it wasn't. It was to obtain data that would be used to design and develop the transportation system.
Do a study.
Not a study, okay. Just obtain
data. I don't quibble over that. Yeah, the question I had was on the loan portfolio that would be appropriated to ADA. And my question in the Loans Committee was, that was, how much money were you expecting the project to receive from those funds? And I believe we agreed it was $18 million, so I added the 18 and the 3 and the 12 together, and I said $33 million. And you said, right, that's what you expect as far as cash that might otherwise be available to the state. And then another person came up and testified and observed that in a letter to Arla Sturgiluski, I think it was from the Department of Commerce, I'm not sure, where they discussed the probability that another $13 million in early payments on those loans would be expected in FY86. In fact, had been counted in the revenue projections in the March forecast. So there appeared to me to be some confusion about that, but it finally appeared to me that, in fact, another $13 million would be required or would be appropriated, at least in terms of what the state had expected to receive. So that would bring a total of $46 million. So I wonder what your response or what your comment on that is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cotton, that is in a letter to Senator Sturgiluski from the Department of Revenue, not Department of Commerce. The $31.3 million that you referred to was the estimate that the Department of Revenue had made on as far as estimating the cash flow on the loan portfolio that's owned by the Department of Revenue. That is part of the current revenue forecast that the Department of Revenue has put together. After doing the kind of research, the detailed research needed to answer Senator Sturgiluski's question, it was determined by the department that the actual cash flow to be expected is $17.8 million. The difference between the $31.3 and the $17.8, which is $13.5 million, will be treated by the Department of Revenue as a downward adjustment when they make their next revenue forecast, along with all the other adjustments that they will use in the next revenue forecast, I believe in June.
So therefore, the Department of Revenue nor the Department of Commerce expect the 12 or 13.5, I guess it was $13.5 million in early payments on those loans. Is it you at one point, Department of Revenue expected at one point, and now you don't expect it? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, on that particular question, I really wouldn't want to answer for the Department of Revenue. I believe
Mel Parker is here.
It's been bugging me ever since that meeting, and I read that letter, and it was really confusing as to what was expected. I think the paragraph concluded that it didn't make any difference, and that's what really confused me, because, you know, as close as we're budgeting this year, $13.5 million, somebody said it really didn't make any difference. I just didn't understand what they could possibly mean by that. That's all I had. I
want
to wait for revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to that toll schedule stuff just so I understand, just so I'm clear on what the language means. Not that I can't find that bill now. That section 1C, what does that mean, Ed Terry or Bird? What does that mean to you, the way it reads?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duncan, what 1C means to me is that in addition to the toll, which would be essentially a baseline toll that we would have a take-or-pay contract to cover, there would be a possible kicker on top of that. That would be tied to the price of zinc. And this is something that we have already talked in general terms with Minko about, and we've always talked in terms of a kicker above the baseline toll.
So the baseline toll, if zinc prices rise, you could go back in and raise the rates.
That's right.
Could not decrease the rates.
Not below the baseline.
Not below the baseline.
Unless in the case of they could be periodically adjusted. If there's a new user, if a lot of new users come in, we can reduce them. But initially, we're certainly going to not reduce them to the point that our bonds would be injured.
Okay, well, that was my second part of the question. 1C says, in your mind, you can't go below the baseline. I mean, you're going to set a baseline rate, and if the price of zinc goes up, the tolls can go up, but if the price of zinc falls, the price of zinc falling alone doesn't say you'll be adjusting the toll rates down.
Not below the baseline.
Below the baseline.
Could go down to zero.
Pardon?
The kicker that went up could go down to zero.
Right, but the baseline would stay. You couldn't go below the baseline. And we don't even know what the baseline is because all that's part of the final financial package that we'll have after we adjourn. Right. Okay. Or somewhere we'll have it. But anyway, we'll see that. Five, then, subsection five down there, says that the toll schedule may be periodically adjusted to ensure a reasonable return on the state's investment in the project and guarantee equitable access to facilities by all users. So taking those one at a time, 5A means what to you?
5A means that, just I think what Representative Sun said, that that the toll fee should generate a reasonable return on the state's investment, and it could be getting the money back, or it could be something in addition to that. But well, that's basically it.
Okay, but again, you wouldn't see, you would set that expected reasonable rate at the beginning. You don't see that that would mean that we'd be going down to zero tolls based on that alone? Or at what point would it be possible to go down to where there would be no toll required?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duncan, there is no intention at this point to have zero tolls.
Okay, how about B, where it says guarantees equitable access to facilities by all users? I don't know for sure what that means, but there's another development out there, another user comes in and he says, we just can't afford to pay what Cominco is paying for the toll. You say we understand. What takes precedent? What if adjusting it down so they can afford it puts us below a reasonable rate of return on our investment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duncan, what takes precedent, first of all, is our financial security for our bondholders, and then secondly, the return on the state's investment.
So if someone said, we can't afford the toll, and you know, if it's X dollars, and we can only afford X minus whatever it is, and if it caused problems with the security on the bonds, or if it wasn't giving us a reasonable rate of return, you still wouldn't adjust downward.
That's correct.
I hope that's correct, because what this language says is that you have to. It says that you've got to set a toll rate that guarantees equitable access to the facilities by all users. It appears to me that a second user coming in could force those toll rates down with that kind of language. I just want to clarify that to be sure that's not the case, because it appears to me that a second user might be able to say, we can't afford to pay anything. And the language here says that you're guaranteeing, you're saying a toll schedule guarantees they can use it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duncan, a user can't demand anything. It would enter into a contract with the authority, and that contract would have to be approved by the board of directors of the authority. So a user can't guarantee that.
But we're guaranteeing them equitable access.
Right. But that doesn't mean that they can dictate what they pay for.
Mr. Chairman, may I just make a comment? I think Representative Duncan may have a point, and just perhaps what would clarify it would be we have item 5 there, and we have 5A. Maybe if you change B to 6 to separate it from tolls, and then basically you're saying your guarantees equitable access, and then if Naranda or someone comes in, we're going to guarantee that we'll have subsequent users, but it's not related to 5, the preceding on tolls, and I think that would make it clear in my mind. I think he's raised a valid point, sir.
Yeah, I think that would help, Mr. Chairman. I hadn't noticed that before in the Loans Committee. I think there is a possibility of a conflict there, so I think Mr. Wagner's suggestion is good, and I'll propose that later if it's okay.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Erla has pointed out something. I believe Representative Duncan's concerns may be covered. If you just deleted B and look at item 7, reasonable access to the port and road is guaranteed to all users. So that based upon that, you could delete B, in my opinion, sir.
That may be, I hadn't noticed that either, because that's added into the, that's not in the Loans Committee substitute, but it's being proposed in the Finance Committee substitute. So I hadn't noticed that either. I think that would be sufficient also, just to delete B out of the Finance Committee substitute and put 7 in. Yeah.
Any further questions? Mr. Pushaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Duncan was pursuing was exactly my question, and I think it's somewhat addressed, but I would still like maybe in terms of like a real live example, see how you would view the provisions contained in 1A and then 5, and assuming for a moment 5 as we have suggested it might be clarified. If we're talking about one operator, Cominco, and you set a toll, and as I read this, it would cover, if we had one operator, that toll would cover two things. One, the cost of operation maintenance, and and 2 containing 5, a quote, fair, reasonable rate of return on the state's investment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman? Sir, that's exactly my understanding.
Now, and then the question that follows up what Representative Duncan was discussing, if we have Noranda coming on, say, in 2 or 5 years with the lick deposit, they come in, you set a toll for them, does the total of their combined tolls still equal the same cost of maintenance and operation and the same reasonable rate of return? Or, and I think what we would want to see is that you would have the ability to not forget the zinc rise, but just at that stage raise the total level of rate of return to the state and not divide a, quote, reasonable rate of return between subsequent operators.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porcello, that, in fact, is, we do have that ability to do that, and it's not our intention to split that. On O&M, that would probably be split among all users on an equitable basis, but other return would be on top of that.
Any further questions? Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to zero in again on debt service, and I wonder if anyone, if either of you would have an opinion on just specifically making it clear that debt service, the payment of debt service, is to be provided for in that toll schedule. And just to put something out in front of you, just on page 3, just as one of those terms at the top, say, provides for the full payment of debt service. And I think that's the intent, but I want to see if that puts a monkey wrench in the works to specifically say that.
Mr. Chairman, may I answer your question? Representative Rieger, if you did that, I think you would vastly diminish the opportunities for tax-exempt financing, because what, in effect, you will be doing, you will be linking the payments that Cominco makes to the payment that ADA makes on the bonds, and you will be running afoul then of what is called, I believe, the security interest test in the federal tax code, and our opportunities for tax-exempt financing will be vastly diminished, sir.
I know the provision you're talking about, and I'm trying to, you know, I wish there's a technical point, because this is also an excluded facility from those kind of rulings as a port, or as an extension of a port. Well, I guess I'd, in lieu of that, and I'll think about that, are you willing to say on the record, so that we at least have it, that that's what you have in mind? It's the full payment of debt service, and then to the extent that cash flow off these loans makes up for some of that debt service, that's regarded as state investment, and that's what gets repaid with the reasonable rate of return. Is that?
That's fair. Mr. Chairman, I think that's a fair statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So any further questions? Thank you, too.
Thank you very much.
At this time, the chair will call up Milt Parker. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, sir. Milt Parker, Deputy Commissioner, Treasury Department of Revenue.
Mr. Barker, you heard the questions from Representative Cotton in regards to the difference between the Department of Revenue's estimation of 31.5 and the actual number of $17 million there, 17.8. Can you put some light on this one?
Yes, sir. What is built into the amount available for appropriation this year is the $31.3 million, as I think you understand. As a result of doing work on this bill, for the first time, a schedule of the actual principal and interest payments due on these loans in the aggregate was developed, and that's the $17.8 million, what is actually due. Additional work in doing this probably indicates that the expected cash flow from the loans is somewhere in between the two, and it's pretty much a guess as to where that's going to be. The budget estimate was done in a lot rougher manner than the detailed estimates that were done here. In any event, the net result is that the consequence of appropriating the loans is a reduction and the amount estimated to be available for appropriation of $31.3
million. Ripson, Cotton.
So, therefore, what is the amount available for appropriation?
I don't have those figures in front of me, but it would be
2.9 minus?
It would be $31.3 million less than.
Than what the March forecast announced?
Yes, sir.
I don't, and if I could continue. The administration does not believe this adjustment materially affects the March revenue forecast. What does that mean?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really can't say. All I can say is that the dollar effect is $31.3 million.
I think that's material. I guess that's just a matter of opinion. I mean, I hate to jump on my good friend Mel, but I think it's significant and it's material, and that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Does anybody want any further questions?
Yeah, let me ask
Ron. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Ron Lynn with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
We have a question from Representative Ringstead. Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lynn, on that, the Anchorage Airport, $24 million, is that a new project, so to speak, or is that a cost overrun?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringstead, that would be a new project. The bond issues in this case have, if you will, the original statute that authorized this bond level was, say it said $10 million, and every time there's an additional issue, the amount, total authorization is increased, so it's no indication of a supplemental. What this money is aimed at is what's been called Phase 2 terminal renovation. I'm sure you're all familiar with the work that's being done now. The department feels the major area that needs improvements at the Anchorage Airport now are direct services for the traveling public in terms of additional baggage claim space and additional space in the upper level in front of the ticket counters and in that area. The project is not firm, if you will. The price estimate for the project is about $18 million. The difference is the cost of bond sale, payment of interest during construction, and payments into the reserves. The airlines that operate there and the department have been meeting considerable length of time trying to decide exactly which is the most reasonable thing to do right now. This level of funding would allow sufficient funding basically to push the entire building out over the existing driving ramps. In other words, the front of the building would move out and you would create a new ramp structure in front of that. Quite frankly, one of the possibilities is that the farther we get into this, that it may be determined that the best thing to do is to only move the baggage claim area, in other words, only move the lower wall out to the edge of the ramp structure. Thereby, you'd save the cost of building a new ramp. You'd still have greatly expanded space in the baggage claim area, which is one of the definite needs, and as part of that, in our capital budget, there was also a project requesting money for design work to begin on a parking structure there. These two projects will be coordinated in the design, and the thought is now that we would have this design work coordinated with that design work, looking at probably some sort of an underground access being designed in to go to the eventual parking garage. There's no money requested right now for construction of a parking garage at the airport there.
So we haven't even finished spending the $63 million of the addition that we got under construction, and now we're deciding we have to come in with another $24 million worth of expenditures. For keep up with that?
Mr. Chairman, may I? Evidently, I wasn't very clear. The $63 million is the total amount of bond issues that have ever been spent at that airport from international airport revenue bonds. The last issue, I think, was $28 million for the work.
28 is what's the work that's been going
right
on for the last
year. So before year the last issue, this would have read, 62 minus 28, a request to increase that authorization. Right, that project should be complete. Current estimates are mid-June. We expect occupancy in even in the new area, the expanded commuter area, by July 1st. And that was always couched as a phase one with the idea that there will be a need, and we feel even a stronger need now that we have the concourse areas set up so that they can handle additional passengers to do something in that baggage claim and up front in the ticket queuing areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pushill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lind, I've been looking for you to talk to for a long time. Money for reconstruction, we funnel down all the arriving passengers down a single flight of stairs to the baggage claim. And I guess in all of this, are we going to expand the ramping and the escalator system down to the baggage claim area? I'm looking at, I have this little chart.
Maybe I should clarify. I'm with the financial division here in Juneau. I'm not part of the connected with the design, but that's my understanding that this would be a complete, it would involve improving access from the upper level down to the lower level in the terminal.
Well, I would just say generally that I think this is long overdue, and as I found out a few weeks back, that most of the work that we see going on the Anchorage Airport has been for asbestos removal, I think, so far, hasn't it been? That, I mean, we really haven't done much. A lot of that money went for asbestos removal, I think.
Much of the current project went for that type of change. Also, mechanical improvements in terms of air handling, meeting fire code, and other changes in the terminal. Of course, there's a good amount of work that went on in terms of pushing the terminal out to one, adding that one wing for commuter type and other carriers down where the western area was. There's now that expansion on there, and that was a considerable amount of the work that was done.
It's also been my understanding that the Anchorage Airport actually pays its own way and contributes to this, to the airport revenue fund, doesn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may take a minute, the two airports, both Anchorage and Fairbanks Airport, are contained in the fund, and as such, we consider them a system, and the system is self-supporting and does generate money which will pay for this. It is true that the Anchorage Airport does generate more than the cost of its operation and its share of the debt service. That's true.
Mr. Chairman, I may be naive as to how these two things happen to end up on the same bill, and I'm sure there may be some other politics I don't know about it, but I sure support improvements of the Anchorage Airport, and I think they can go far statewide, and I don't think this costs us any money. I'd like to voice support for this.
Any further questions? Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this particular bill?
Sure.
Yes.
I have another quick question for Bert Wagner.
Yes.
The legislature last year appropriated $3.4 million for geotechnical studies, routing, engineering, design, and acquisition for the DeLong Mountain Regional Port. I gave you that money, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
For the port. How much of that do you have left?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was $3.4 million. We have in excess of $3 million left. Expenditures to date on that financing plan contract was $267,000. Other expenditures have been very minor, Mr. Chairman, probably all total less than $15,000 or $20,000.
The financing plan for...
Mr. Chairman, we're required by statute to prepare a finance plan. We felt that this project was of such a magnitude, instead of doing it in-house, we put out a RFP and hired a consulting firm, Stanford Research Institute, to review the project for us, sir.
What is the current status of it?
Mr. Chairman, SRI will be presenting an oral draft report, I believe it is Monday, the 29th, to the Board of Directors of ADA. And they will have a written draft plan available the following week. Final finance plan, subject to public comment, and staff ADA review and public comment is scheduled to be completed by mid-August.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
No further questions at this time. Mr. Chair will entertain a motion to adopt committee substitute for House Bill number 105, Finance. Representative Reed, next step.
Mr. Chairman, I will move ask unanimous consent. We adopt the finance draft before us as the finance CS.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Duncan.
Chairman, on the finance committee substitute, I would move that on page 3, line 4, that we delete subsection B. That'd be lines, I guess it's lines 3 and 4, page 3.
At the subsection B?
Subsection B, right.
Objection for discussion?
Yeah, objection for purpose of discussion. I would encourage a friendly amendment or a modification because there's only one subsection left, A, that perhaps the sentence beginning on the bottom of page 2 just run on project that scratch subsection A and make it one sentence.
I think that makes sense.
No objection to that friendly amendment and representative.
Are we under discussion? Or
under discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'd feel more comfortable if, as part of that amendment also, on line 7, what reads reasonable access to the port and road is guaranteed, that read reasonable and equitable access, so that the concept of equitable access is maintained.
Representative Rieger, can we take care of this particular one regarding 5, section 5, and then
sure.
We can go on to yours?
Sure.
Hearing no objection, that one has been adopted. Representative Rieger.
Mr. Chairman, I move to add the two words and equitable on line 7, page 3, line 7, after the word reasonable.
Would you read it in content?
To read, it's reasonable and equitable access to the port and road is guaranteed to all users.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, your amendment is adopted. Is there anything else? Representative Ringstaff.
Mr. Chairman, there's nothing else. I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we pass out the finance CS for House Bill 105 as we've amended it.
It has an accompanying fiscal note to go with it also for the airport.
Is there any objections,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, just for the purpose of discussion, Mr. Chairman, I hate to hold this up. I was in one last time reading through this on section 3, which starts on page 1. The way I read this, the bill provides that the terms on subparagraph or on paragraph 1, letter A, B, and C, shall be incorporated into the final finance plan. Does everyone read that to mean that means what will be incorporated into the final agreement, not just the finance plan, but the deal itself?
Either Mr. Elder or Mr. Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, the finance plan is essentially the rock upon which the contracts are based, and so that will be, what's in the finance plan will be incorporated.
Last one. I'd like to go back to the very first question I asked about the agreement in writing and whether that could be worded by valid enforceable contract.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rieger, we, as I mentioned, the word take or pay, we intend to have enforceable contracts with respect to all these.
Okay. Representative Pushill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to note for the record that prior to my election, I was working for NANA Development Corporation, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of NANA Regional Corporation, which owns the mineral deposit that could be benefited by funding and transportation development under this bill.
So noted. Is there any objections to moving this bill out of committee? Committee substitutes for House Bill number 105, Finance and Fiscal Note is moved out of committee. House Finance is adjourned.
Oh, shit.
House Bill number 353, an act relating to oil and gas taxation and providing for an effective date. Representative Cotton, you are the chair of this particular legislation. Representative Cotton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the Assistant Attorney General has been working on this case, has been working with us on some proposed technical amendments, and she is prepared now to testify. Would you like to just join us up here? Does anybody else have
it? I haven't seen you see it.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Botello. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue for Taxation. At your direction, the department has met with representatives of the Department of Law, specifically Deborah Vogt, and members of your staff, and in particular with Mr. John Messenger, to put together a proposed committee substitute on HB 353. Deborah will be making the section-by-section analysis for you. We also have representatives of the department who are present today to answer any additional technical questions which may arise as we go through the particular bill. I do want to make one specific disclaimer, and that is that the bill amendments that are proposed in this committee substitute should not be construed as an endorsement by the department or the administration for this particular version. It is our understanding, and we have proceeded with the idea of trying to make this bill the best bill possible under the principles that the committee has embodied in the original HB 353. With that, I'd ask Ms. Vogt to proceed with the section-by-section analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Deborah Vogt, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the state. In your packages, you'll see an explanation of the proposed changes and a redrafted bill. And the way the bill is redrafted is to show for the first, I think it's 12 pages of the bill, it sets out HB 353 in its original form and represents the department's proposed changes as underlinings and deletions. I thought this would be easiest for the committee to follow. Starting on page 12, the underlining and deleting method was abandoned because the department suggests reorganizing and fairly substantially redrafting the sections on reporting and filing and so on that appear on pages 12, 13, 14, and the top of 15. And then at the bottom of 15, we go back to the underlining and deleting method. And then on page 17, the last page of the bill, that's all entirely new material. So I hope that's sort of clear as we go through. The department's changes really are in four basic areas. There are some fairly minor language changes throughout the bill so that oil and gas are consistently changed to oil or gas in case somebody's engaged in one and not the other. The word incurred is changed to accrued as a more technical, more precise accounting term. The applicability section that the law applies to a taxpayer who is engaged in or deriving income from. So those kinds of changes appear throughout the bill. They're really fairly insignificant, and maybe we don't need to go over them line by line. The second major change is on those pages 13 through or 12 through 15, I guess, which are the reporting and return requirements. And when the separate accounting bill, AS 4321, was originally drafted, I think I may have mentioned in past testimony that there was a tremendous fear on the part of the administration that the separate accounting methodology would be difficult to administer, and so some fairly extraordinary reporting requirements were adopted at that time. The changes on those pages 12 to 15 reflect our experience with the law, which was that it was not particularly any more difficult to administer than the regular corporate income tax, and the extraordinary provisions for reporting were on the whole unnecessary, so that where the old law provided that a certain calculation would be made by the department, in practice the calculation was made by the taxpayer, subject to audit by the department if it was necessary. And so these revisions on those pages really bring Chapter 22, or proposed Chapter 22, in line with current Chapter 20 as far as reporting procedures are concerned, with one exception, and this is a hangover from the separate accounting, the old separate accounting bill. There is a notice of adjustment that's required, or that's allowed under proposed Chapter 22 that I don't believe exists in Chapter 20, and that's just basically if there's a mathematical error on the return when it comes in, the department can send you a notice of adjustment so that you would pay up immediately on that kind of a error or omission on your return, whereas it might not be so important under Chapter 20. The third change recommended by the department deals with the modifications that are necessary when Chapter 20 interacts with Chapter 22. And those in HB 353 were drafted to appear in two places, once in Chapter 20 and again in Chapter 22. The department has recommended using those provisions only once and referring back to them the second time they appear. The fourth change was one that partly was my omission in drafting the bill and was brought to the committee's attention by former Commissioner Tom Williams testifying on behalf of SERI, and that was that Chapter 20 needed to be changed to provide for oil and gas production income that might be received under the provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that require the distribution of those kinds of income among the regional native corporations. And so that language appears, and we'll go through the bill page by page in a while, in three places in the redraft proposed by the department. Finally, the last page of the bill deals with the substantial reorganization that was necessary to allow for the possibility, to provide for the possibility that the U.S. Supreme Court may reverse the state Supreme Court and we go back to the current method of taxation. So with those general comments, I'll go through the bill page by page. You do have the explanation on these four short pages here. And I'd be happy to stop if anybody has any specific questions. The first page, the title would be recommended to be changed. the original title said Taxation of Oil and Gas Corporations, since the severance tax is philosophically a tax on oil and not on corporations. The department recommended changing the title to just say an act relating to oil and gas taxation. The department recommends deleting the findings in Section C and D, which is the bottom of page 1 and all of page 2, primarily because these are very specific findings dealing with the present modified apportionment system, and they would be helpful if we were faced with the possibility that separate accounting is unconstitutional. We were sued on the constitutionality, but since this law would not come into effect unless there's an affirmative finding on the constitutionality, the department feels that these findings are unnecessary and probably too detailed. The bottom of page 2, you see first the change, the addition of the words deriving income from. The bottom of page 3 is the section that refers general corporate income taxpayers to the separate accounting statute if they are engaged in or deriving income from exploration, production, or pipeline transportation. The underlying material at the very bottom there is the first time you see the reference to the Native Claims Settlement Act distributions, and this language tells you that if you receive income under those distributions, you either pay tax on that income under the general corporate income tax or under the apportionment provisions of Chapter 22. the department moved the language telling you how to adjust your income to bring it into sort of a mirror image of what happens under Chapter 22, the modifications that are made to the apportionment formula, move them into Section 31 of Chapter 20 instead of Section 11. Section 11 really just sets the income tax rate and tells who the chapter applies to. Section 31 is the more appropriate place to talk about adjustments to taxable income. So you'll see at the top of the page those sections are taken out and the bottom of the page is put back in a different place. Page 5, we have the first section of Chapter 22, and it was revised, or is proposed to be revised by the department, just to make it more clear that the chapter does in fact levy a tax, so that the application talks about imposing a tax rather than merely that the chapter applies to those kinds of corporations. Section 020, then, is the determination of taxable income from exploration and production. The department recommends putting in a paragraph on gross income from exploration, and This just provides for the possibility, as you know, the definition of exploration only includes those kinds of activities that a company does in anticipation of its own production. In other words, if you are exploring on contract on behalf of somebody else, you are not under the definition of exploration used in Chapter 22, and your income would not be subject to separate accounting then. But it is possible that a company might do some exploration and spend some money in exploration activities and then decide to sell that information to another oil company. And therefore, I guess it's possible that a producer might have some income from those kinds of exploration activities. So Section B would simply provide a place for that income to show up. Section C begins with gross income for oil production and deletes two sentences that deal with establishing value at the point of production. Those sentences required the department to establish regulations and listed three alternatives that the department might use in making that determination. The concept of both of those sentences is implied in the added language there, as determined by the department by regulation. The department preferred removing those sentences to avoid any argument that those sentences limited the kinds of things that the department could look at in establishing value at the point of production. On page 6, Alaska Pipeline Commission was changed to Alaska Public Utilities Commission because the Pipeline Commission doesn't exist anymore. Section D there, here's one of those by the department taken out because the calculation is really made by the taxpayer. Subsection 1, these are deductions now from gross income of production. Section 1 is royalties paid in kind or in value, and the additional language makes it clear that if a lease owner retains his interest in the lease but has, for example, pledged part of his production in the form of an overriding royalty or a production payment to another party as, for example, the repayment of a loan, that kind of an arrangement would not give rise to a deduction under the separate accounting provisions. Otherwise, he'd be able to pay back his loan with after-tax interest. After-tax income. This is kind of a confusing area because royalties aren't really philosophically appropriately a deduction from gross income. It's more appropriate to consider the royalty owner as a separate part of the lease, and therefore, so if there are other true overriding royalties or other royalties that a lessee may have with another party in which the lessee has given up a part of his interest in the land, then the oil produced from that part of the interest in the land is not gross income to this taxpayer, and so deduction for those payments is not necessary under this section. Here we begin with the change of incurred to accrued, which is just a better accounting term. At the bottom of page 6, number 4, direct costs, the tail end of the sentence was moved to the parentheses at the beginning, and the reference to the windfall profit tax was inserted by the department so that so long as the committee does not want a deduction permitted for the windfall profit tax, this obviates the possibility that someone might argue that the windfall profit tax is deductible anyway as a direct cost. So then at the top of page 7, a number of people who read the statute couldn't understand what but net of meant, so the department changed it to less. Deduction number 5 is depreciation. The unit of production method used under old Chapter 21 and used, which would be used under Chapter 22, involves making an estimation of the reserves, because that's what the unit of production depreciates a property over the foreseeable extraction of the reserves. And the added language there would allow the department to adopt reserve estimates, not necessarily those presented by the taxpayer. In other words, it could use the reserve estimates developed by the Department of Natural Resources, by some outside source, or by the taxpayer. This just simply permits the department some flexibility in that area. The old 4321 depreciated capitalized interest, but it wasn't clear on the face of the statute capitalized under whose rules, so the department has added language that makes it clear that it's the interest that is required to be capitalized for federal income tax purposes. And finally, in that depreciation deduction The department suggests adding the language, including intangible drilling and development costs. Those are costs that, under federal rules, can be expensed in the year in which they're incurred. Under 4321, they were always required to be capitalized. And this additional language just makes it clear that that capitalization is necessary. Section 6 has the same changes as regarding incurred and accrued, and the same changes on capitalized, explaining what whose rules of capitalizing you're following. And also the department suggests adding payments and taxes to modify both. When I read this first, I thought it meant both AS-2953 and 4356. It means both payments and taxes, so that language just clarifies that. Subsection 7, the same accrued and same capitalized changes. Subsection 8, paid or accrued instead of incurred. 9 is the same kinds of changes. The top of page 9 in subsection 10 is the second place then that you see the reference to the income distributed under the Native Claim Settlement Act. And here now we are in the separate accounting provision for gross deductions from gross income, so that income that you have, that if you're the Native corporation and you are producing, you are an oil producer, the income that you have to distribute to the other corporations becomes a deduction under this section from your gross income. Any that comes back to you shows up again a few pages later as apportionable income, and we'll get to that in a minute. Other than the language changes on 9, that's all. The only thing on page 10 was an inadvertently omitted energy from Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Page 10, then, talks about the determination of income from activities other than exploration, production, and pipeline transportation. And here is the third place that you see the ANGSCA distributable income show up. And so that is, if you are a producer and you send that income out among the other corporations, some of it's going to come back to you. That income gets taxed under the apportionment provisions of Section 040 rather than under the separate accounting provisions of 020. So essentially, it's all treated the same no matter whether it's coming or going. This section, as was drafted originally in 353, made the same modifications to apportionable income that we make up back here in 4320 on page 4, I guess it is. Yeah, the bottom of page 4. So the department recommends simply referring the taxpayer back to those modifications that are made in Chapter 20, and that way it's clear that the identical modifications will be made for apportionable income both under 4320 and 4322. So all the adjustments are taken out of 040 in 4322. I might mention that under 4321 and 353, it was originally drafted, it was necessary then to have these subsections 1 and 2 that are deleted because there had to be a provision that if you had a foreign subsidiary, for example, that didn't pay federal taxes, you could allow it to calculate its taxes as though it were a federal taxpayer. Since that provision already appears elsewhere in Chapter 20, it's unnecessary now. Subsection D did not get transported to Chapter 20. It's a fairly particularized application of the apportionment formula for a specific situation that the department felt was better handled by regulation than in the statute. On page 12, then, we start with a completely revised sections that the department has recommended substituting for the payments and penalties and other kinds of enforcement provisions. And I won't go over those in detail. They're just basically what we've got in 4320, incorporating some, to the extent possible, some provisions of federal law. Back at the bottom of page 15, the definition section, the department recommended narrowing the definitions incorporated out of Chapter 55 to just certain of those definitions, and recommended some changes to the definition of exploration to include the concept that the person to be exploring under this statute would have to be bearing the financial risk of a project and make it clear that it's not somebody like Parker Drilling who's working on contract for one of the producers, that it really has to be the person with the working interest or with the potential working interest. Department also suggested including a definition of real and tangible personal property, and that term shows up in the two provisions that allow a deduction up to a certain cap for administration and overhead and interest unless the taxpayer can show that his actual expenses are greater than that cap. And the cap is calculated on the basis of a formula that includes a property factor, and the department here would like to make it clear that that property factor should include those intangible drilling and development costs that we were talking about before. There are no changes to the severance tax provision, Section 5. The last page of the bill, Sections 6 through 13, are fairly substantially and complexly rewritten, but I hope I can make it clear what it is that they're supposed to do. Section 6 would readopt the present law, the present modified apportionment law, and that's because that law will be repealed if this law, if HB 353 becomes effective, so that if we were to go back to it on an adverse Supreme Court decision, we'd have to reenact it. So Section 6 would reenact it, but it has the effective date in Section 13, which is only if Chapter 22 is found invalid. Section 7 repeals the section that we just reenacted, and that's effective on the state Supreme Court holding that the separate accounting method is constitutional. Section 8 is the retroactivity section dealing with the separate accounting provisions of HB 353, making it retroactive to January 1, 1985, and that, of course, would become effective under Section 12 on an affirmative decision from the state Supreme Court. Section 9 tells you that the severance tax provision in Section 5 applies to oil produced after December 31st, 1986. Section 10 repeals both the separate accounting and the severance tax provisions and is effective on an adverse holding from the U.S. Supreme Court or if 4322 is otherwise found unconstitutional. Section 11 is the retroactivity section that goes with the applicability sections that come into effect only on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. And Section 12 is the effective date for the basic provisions of 353. Section 13 is an effective date which would come into play only if the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the state Supreme Court or if 4322 were found invalid by a court from which an appeal was not taken. So that the way Section 13 is drafted, hopefully, what it does is the U.S. Supreme Court strikes 4321. The Attorney General then would certify whether or not that decision clearly implicated the statute 4322, this law. And if it was clear that it did, then the Attorney General's certification would bring into effect the replacement provisions of the current law. If it was not clear, or if we felt we could defend 4322, even though 4321 had been, even though we had an adverse decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, then we would obviously end up in court real quick, and this section would take effect on the final judgment of the court. That's it.
Representative Cotton?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to be clear here, the department, I discussed with the Department of Law the possibility of the windfall profits tax exemption, and that was not included in your recommendation, was it?
It is not included in this bill,
right.
No.
That's something that that would be easily added as an exemption or a deduction for the corporate income tax. I'm sort of leaning towards doing that, but I would prefer just to adopt this CES at the moment. We still are waiting for some information from the Department of Revenue, so I wouldn't recommend that we move the bill out of committee today. But I would at this time move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the committee substitute for 353.
So any objections?
Jack.
Representative Healy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions while we've got you both up here. Are there any changes in the committee substitute that actually change anything as far as the raise in taxes from the original committee substitute? Or are these just mainly accounting changes?
Mr. Chairman, I'd respond, and the purpose of the bill, of course, was to require the oil and gas producing corporations to show their profits in Alaska for purposes of paying income taxes. That hasn't changed any. The backstop provisions that were described on the last page are new, and the technical amendments that that Ms. Volk described in her general comments describe the different types of amendments, but none of the amendments that you'll see there or in the CS were designed to, quote, raise taxes, if that was your question.
That is the question. And also, Mr. Chairman, if I might continue, I notice there's a lot of technical things that are occurring here. I understand that this is mainly accounting changes that are occurring. Maybe they could answer exactly what we're talking about, some of the accounting changes. I see there are different changes on lines and so on. What's the net effect of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the bill is remains very consistent with what the committee asked for in HB 353. The department did not approach this from, well, it approached it from the perspective of how to make this bill the best bill that did what the committee intended to do. And so I don't think there are any changes that have been proposed by the department that do any violence at all to the overall concepts proposed by the committee. In fact, I can't think how there would be any revenue impact from any of the changes. I think I would characterize the changes as clarification rather than as changes.
I think the only, in terms of specific language, as you see, Ms. Volk pointed out the use of the word accrued as opposed to incurred. Those are the accounting kinds of changes, concepts that are more specifically applicable and understandable to persons in that field.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue then. So in other words, the changes in here, in your opinion then, in technical, are really technical changes that were oversights that were not presented originally.
That's correct.
In the original committee substitute that you've now had a chance to review. And are there any other substantive changes besides just the technical changes that you're testifying to?
No,
let me give you an example, Mr. Chairman. We talk on page 2, line 10, about some changes here in the windfall profits tax. Is there any changes in that as far as that? Of course, that's a federal situation, but is that going to change any accounting for these companies?
I'd respond to that after it's deferred. The original bill did not grant a deduction for the windfall profits tax. The language that's on page 2 you're referring to. I guess it was page 2. I didn't think it was page 2.
Page 6, I'm sorry, but number 10 on the front
right.
section.
That intent was to clarify that deduction was not granted, and that was the intent in the original 353. Again, as I mentioned, I think that some people would suggest that exemption should be granted, as it was in 1981. But in this CS, it wasn't to start with, and it still isn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rieger.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most of the questions I think I can reserve for the general discussion on the bill, but I just wanted to refer you to page 7, paragraph 5, or subparagraph 5. Are you saying that the changes there are not changing the taxable income under the three sections being underlined there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language changes in paragraph 5 really reflect the department's practice under former 4321. And the first sentence, based on reserves estimates adopted by the department, just simply clarifies that the department is not bound by the reserve estimates of the taxpayer, which it did not perceive itself to be under former 4321. The second sentence is simply a clarification of whose rules you're using regarding capitalized interest, interest that was required to be capitalized for federal purposes, just to clarify exactly what you're talking about there. And finally, the intangible drilling costs under former 4321 were always capitalized and depreciated and were never expensable, even though they are expensable under the federal rules. And the old law was always read to require that those expenditures be capitalized. This simply clarifies that they are indeed to obviate any argument about it. So in other words, I guess a lot of the changes reflect experience with the old 4321 and simply make clarifications that came out of that experience.
Mr. Chair, I can save the rest of my questions for the discussion of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a general question. Is it okay to ask a general question?
Sure.
Have you guys analyzed the sensitivity to the Alaskan operations, or the sensitivity of the Alaskan operations of these multinational corporations, and whether our or Alaskan operations are more sensitive to price changes, and whether that would have the proposed change in the law would have a less stabilizing influence on their on our revenues or not?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I might try to summarize.
Let me just maybe clarify a little bit. Assuming the prices went down dramatically, the production costs up here are higher, transportation costs are higher, and we could conceivably get to a place much quicker where our operations were not as profitable as operations in other places in the world.
I might just point out that the HB 353 does two things. It changes both the corporate income tax and the severance tax. And I think that the numbers that revenue is going to be providing you will help in this area considerably. But I think one thing that is pretty clear is that in 81 we moved dollars from the income tax into the severance tax. This bill would move them back again, more dollars in income tax and less dollars in severance tax. So you've got two things that affect that sensitivity. One is how much are you depending on severance versus income, and the other is how much does either income tax system, how sensitive is either income tax system. And I think that from Greg Erickson's testimony, if I'm, maybe he'd like to come talk about it, that the severance tax is quite sensitive to price changes, obviously, because that's all it's based on, and that the separate accounting is probably more sensitive than modified apportionment to price changes, but that okay that.
Mr. Chairman, Greg Erickson from the Office of Management and Budget. It's clear that in 1983, which is the 1 year for which we have a good fix on how the two bills would have worked had they been applied to the same year, that the combination contained in 353 and contained in the separate accounting law or the oil tax system as it existed before 1981 would have been less sensitive to changes in price than the system that we now have, which was adopted in 1981. We do not know until we see the fiscal analysis from revenue that subject it to some additional analysis whether or not that situation still holds. But in 1983, it's clear that a dollar change in prices would have had a greater effect under the current law than it would have under this law or the law that existed before 1981.
In either direction, up or down?
In either direction, up or down. In other words, a dollar increase in prices would have brought us less additional revenue under 353. A dollar decrease in prices would have lost us less revenue under 353. But I must emphasize, we don't know whether that characteristic still holds or not.
Thank you. Any further questions? We do have a motion before us that was placed by Representative Cotton. Is there objections?
Mr. Chairman, I will remove my objections at this time.
All right. We do have before us the Finance CS. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this? Because it's going back into subcommittee. If there's any members that have any changes to, please work with Representative Cotton on this. Thank you. We're only going up to 4:15 today, and then if we don't finish today's calendar, we'll be coming back tomorrow at 1:30. The next bill we have is House Bill number 191 before us. This bill deals with school construction and changes the way in which the school reimburses school districts for school construction bond debt service costs and the way in which construction grants are administered and funded. Representative Cotton and Larson have prepared a finance CS for us to consider. Representative Cotton will explain the bill to us. There's approximately $103 in the budget for school construction because the proposed finance CS raised the current reimbursement rate from 50 to 80%. This bill will require another 1.2 in FY86 to fully fund the program. Representative Cotton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Larson and I did get a chance to discuss this bill. We compared it to the bill that had been offered by the HES committee, and there's couple differences that I'll go over. One thing I'd like to talk about first is a fiscal note. That's as a result of, if this bill passed, then we would be making 80% payments instead of 50% payments this next year. That could be adjusted by adjusting effective dates of the bill and postpone that fiscal note for at least 1 year. Basically, the effect of the purpose of the bill was to increase from 50% to 80%.